Hi, in today's episode, we're going to talk about fibroids and estrogen, and if a woman that has fibroids is a candidate for estrogen replacement therapy. I'm Dr. Davidson from Progress Your Health.
And I'm Dr. Mackey from Progress Your Health. So today we're going to talk about Alicia's question. It's pretty in-depth. She's got a lot of detail here. Why don't you go ahead and read the question?
Okay. So question, Alicia, is there any hope for somebody with adenomyosis fibroids to take estrogen? If so, when is the right time? I know fibroids are stimulated by estrogen, and I even had one doctor offer a hysterectomy so that I could take estrogen without any issues. I have a history of heavy periods, and I've had many transvaginal ultrasounds and biopsies over the years. My uterus is enlarged, but my lining isn't with normal limits. I've had a hysteroscopy to remove some cysts, and my last ultrasound showed probable endometriosis fibroids, and I am almost 57, and I am in late perimenopause. My cycles have been erratic. I just went 6 months without a cycle and then had a normal cycle. Most of the time for the last year, I've had symptoms of low estrogen. I have poor sleep, waking up in the night 4 to 5 times, dry skin, vaginal dryness, night sweats, brain fog, difficulty concentrating, which makes my job very difficult. I've also developed a mild sleep apnea, and after my last physical, I am on the edge of prediabetes. I am normal weight, I walk daily, and I lift weights. I eat a high-protein diet with lots of vegetables and healthy fats. I'm currently taking a progesterone troche, which is 1/4 elogens, basically it looks like 50 milligrams twice a day, and vaginal estrogen. I was taking an oral 300 milligram progesterone thought it would help with sleep, but it didn't. The progesterone has helped with my GI issues, puffiness, bloating, cramping, and anxiety.
Well, yeah, there's a lot to bite off there. So where would you start?
Well, I do love the thoroughness of Alicia's question, because as we know, everybody's an individual. It's not like I have hot flashes, but everything else in my life is great. There's always, you know, a cluster of symptoms when it comes to perimenopause and menopause. But definitely, you know, yeah, where would we want to break this down? Because there's so many aspects to it, like there is in a human.
Well, first off, though, she's 57 and she says that she's in late stage perimenopause. What do you think of that?
That's not that common. Most women, you know, at 51 and a half, that's me, almost 51 and a half, I'm 51, is that's when menopause happens. So some people have menopause a little bit earlier in their 40s, late 40s, other women a little bit later. I have had women, and you have too, as patients that have gone through menopause in their mid 50s.
What's the oldest woman you've had that has still had a normal consistent period
without any hormone replacement or anything? 55 that I can remember correctly. I think there might've been a 56 year old in there somewhere, but 55. So I will say, being 57, that is pretty late to go through, you know, menopause, but you know, everybody's different. So let's just assume that now that she went 6 months without a period and then she got a period, that she, see, that's where it gets a little interesting, because she's also taking vaginal estrogen. So we don't know a lot. Now, if she's taking vaginal estradiol, which is E2, that's one of the strongest forms of estrogen. It's probably one of the most common over-the-counter estrogens. If she's doing vaginal estradiol, that would cause a period, you know, because she obviously has a uterus, that can, you know, estradiol is really good at thickening that endometrial lining of the vaginal tissues, and that could cause some irregular bleeding, especially depending on what levels of progesterone she's taking. Now, let's assume maybe she's not taking, or maybe that vaginal estrogen is estriol only, and she's not taking any estradiol, then she could be possibly having a little bit of, you know, more perimenopausal symptoms.
Well, what she's referring to as perimenopause, like you said, the cycles, she went 6 months without a cycle, now she's got a cycle, that could be very easily attributed to the estrogen that she's using.
That's what I'm thinking, because I'm really thinking if she's gone 6 months without a period and then one happened, it's probably having to do with that vaginal estrogen she's taking, that I would really put Alicia more into the menopause. So now in other podcasts, we're going to talk about differences between perimenopause and menopause, and you know, when does one glide into the other? But I would definitely, with her symptoms here, I would absolutely put her in menopause.
Yeah. Well, I don't think, I'm not really sure why she's on, well, I can understand vaginal estrogen because she's having the vaginal dryness, but she's having the fibroids. Most of the time, at least in our experience, most of the time when you are using estrogen of any sort, or when you're going to menopause, the fibroids sort of just become dormant. The estrogen that you give them really doesn't do anything. That's why this one is very unusual. It does happen. Obviously, it's happening to Alicia, but 57, still having a regular cycle, using vaginal estrogen. Oh, those things don't really add up quite right. There's a few clues there that I think the estrogen therapy is actually causing her issue, which is what I'm sure she's asking, but why is she doing it vaginally? She should be doing it systemically, you know, to the inner thigh, some kind of transdermal of some sort.
Well, that's where some of the, everybody has a theory. That's like she was saying, one doctor wanted to give her hysterectomy so she could take the estrogen without any issues. So I do feel like, you know, if you do give the estrogen to somebody that's menopausal, but they have had a history of fibroids, you have to have a delicate balance so you don't flare up those fibroids. I've had patients with past history of fibroids that have gotten flares.
We were just talking about one from the other day. You have one right now that's in that
she
situation.
She has a history of endometriosis and lots of fibroids, and we've always had to be really careful with the amount of estrogen that we give her and keep it really low, just enough to kind of help with the symptoms but not flare up the estrogen. Or sorry, not let the estrogen flare up the fibroids, that she's a little bit more of a, I would say, an isolated case. Most of the time, you know, when you're working with someone that has a history of fibroids, you can pretty much, you know, balance that estrogen therapy to help with the symptoms without aggravating the fibroids.
Now, the one your patient, how old is she compared to Alicia?
She's in her late 50s.
So pretty much in the same situation age-wise. Yeah. Sort of a delicate balance there. But I would agree, that type of situation, either Alicia or your patient, that is the exception to the rule. Mm-hmm. Most of the time, like I said, you go into menopause and the fibroids become kind of a non-issue. They're there forever. They don't go away. You can't get them to... You can't remove them. They're always going to be there. But usually whatever you're using, biased or, you know, whatever, is not going to wake them up, and they're not going to start having more bleeding problems after the fact. Yeah,
because like I was saying, the theory is we don't really know why fibroids happen, but there is that theory that estrogen can aggravate them, or they can be kind of dominated by estrogen. So that's where they'll say, oh, you know, women over the age of 40 tend to have fibroids. And that's because in perimenopause, your progesterone drops down and you have this sort of imbalance of the estrogen. So that could flare up or aggravate or create fibroids. So they also say women that have gone through pregnancies. I don't really know the research on that. I mean, a lot of women have been pregnant and a lot of women have fibroids. Is that more of a correlation or is that a causation?
Well,
I don't know.
Well, if it was just estrogen, that means every pregnant woman should have fibroids then, if it was just about estrogen. Because you're pregnant, your estrogen level skyrockets, your progesterone skyrockets. How many women, I don't know if this research even exists, how many pregnant women that have birthed children, how many of them have had fibroids? I don't know the statistics on that.
A lot of them may not have had fibroids before the pregnancy, but they might have them after the pregnancy. But is that because of pregnancy, or is that just because of genetics, or that estrogen imbalance with the progesterone? You know, I don't know. And a lot of women have fibroids, and, you know, we don't even know we have fibroids. Maybe they've never had a transvaginal ultrasound, and they've never had any symptoms. So there's a little bit of unknowns out there, but I think because of the correlation between estrogen and fibroids, a lot of doctors are hesitant about giving too much estrogen. I would say in Alicia's case, I definitely wouldn't do any estradiol vaginally, because that's so close to the uterus that it could cause that uterine lining to thicken and cause a bleed. I would also, you know, also say she's talking about the adenomyosis. Now, there's different types of fibroids. There's pedunculated, there's subserous, there's even polyps, which aren't really technically fibroids. But now, fibroids are considered a lesion or a mass, but they don't cause cancer. So right. Now, cancer can be hidden because a fibroid is maybe blocking some of the endometrial wall and you can't see it.
On an ultrasound.
So you can't maybe see the lining because the fibroid is covering it, but fibroids don't become cancerous. They're actually very benign, other than the annoying kind of symptoms they can have, especially in a woman that's going from perimenopause to menopause. But I will say adenomyosis is more where where the fibroid, that growth is kind of pushing into, it's in the wall of the uterus and it's kind of pushing in, and it can be very painful. Mm-hmm. Like fibroids can be painful. They can cause heavy bleeding, but adenomyosis, that type of fibroid, that's very painful.
Right. Well, and usually, painful meaning cramping pain or just all the time pain, kind of like an endometriosis type pain.
It kind of depends on the person, but I do know during a period. So when someone's having a period and they have adenomyosis, extremely painful, even fibroids too, because the uterus doesn't know that lesion is part of self. So it thinks there's something in there, like the lining, and it wants to get it out. So the uterus is a muscle. It'll cramp and cramp and cramp and cramp trying to push that out, but it's not going anywhere. So you can have a lot of painful pain there. I don't see too much with fibroids pain mid-cycle with ovulation, like I've seen with endometriosis, or endometriosis has pain pretty much, you know, throughout the entire, you can see it throughout the entire month. Or I even have some women where their pain with endometriosis is so intense during ovulation, but it's really okay during their period. Everybody's different. But I would say with the fibroids, it's more about having that period, or if that uterus is trying to cramp. So just to get, you know, just get more complicated, if somebody is on, taking estrogen hormone replacement therapy or some kind of, you know, menopausal replacement therapy, is if it's not balanced, it can, that uterus can get a little irritated, or even that lining could get a little thick, and it'll constantly like cramp. That's why sometimes when women will say, I haven't gotten a period, I'm not having any spotting, but I just feel bloated and I feel like I'm going to get my period, even though they're menopausal and they haven't had a period for years. That could be because that fibroid is starting to be a little active and it's causing, and that uterus is starting to want to cramp a little bit.
Yeah. Now she says some other things here later on in the question. She talks about being pre-diabetic. However, she says that she walks a lot. She lifts weights, and she eats a high protein diet. So that seems like a little bit of a disconnect. So I'm wondering how, because certainly there's a connection between being insulin resistant, pre-diabetes, insulin resistant, pre-diabetes, and fibroid formation. Would you agree with that? Like there's a little connection there between those types of things? Your proverbial estrogen dominant kind of a situation kind of being partially driven by insulin.
Well, I could, you know, maybe you could explain a little bit more with that. What do you mean?
Well, I'm just picking up on this spot here that this thing that she says in the question that she's pre-diabetic, but her lifestyle sounds very good. Does have mild sleep apnea. Sleep apnea contributes to your lowering insulin sensitivity, which could kind of fuel, you know, what I was just thinking of as we were, you know, reading the question that, you know, 57, sort of still cycling. I you know, if she wasn't on the vaginal estrogen, it'd be nice to know what her FSH level was. What would you suspect hers is? You know, she'd have to remove the estrogen, the vaginal estrogen to get a better reading of that. But if she is in perimenopause or late stage, you would expect her to be a little bit on the lower end of that spectrum. What would you say, 25, 40, 30? You
know? So the follicle-stimulating hormone, or the FSH, is a signal from the brain, the pituitary, that monitors overall, basically ovarian function or how much estrogen's in your system. So if you have a high amount of estrogen, that FSH is low. So when you're 28 years old and you're cycling and you have lots of estrogen, you know, your FSH might be at 2.5 to 5. And then as you get a little older and that estrogen starts to decline, you'll see that FSH level go up. Now, it does change a little bit with the cycle and where you are in your cycle. But I would say for Alicia, being where I would consider her definitely probably, you know, just, you know, kind of cusping into menopause, her FSH level is probably high because she's having a lot of low estrogen symptoms. So I would say, you know, usually you see with postmenopausal women, their FSH can be, you know, 75, well over 100. Mm-hmm. And then I see with sort of more perimenopausal women, they could be anywhere between 25, even up to like 45 or 50, because in going from perimenopause, especially when you're kind of making that transition into menopause, you'll see that FSH bounce up and down. It could be 10 one month, and then you do a blood draw later and it's at, you know, 35. So, and that's why sometimes you don't get a period because that estrogen is dropped, the ovaries went on vacation, and then you get a period 6 months later, and then maybe they came back to work part-time. Because yeah, right. I always say, like, you know, the ovaries a little bit like gremlins when you're in perimenopause going into menopause. They want to work full-time, they want to work part-time, they want to go on vacation, they want to come back. They just do what they want to do. And you never want to bully someone's ovaries in that point because they will have irregular bleeding. They will have weight gain. They will have symptoms. So I would say, you know, kind of to come back to our original question, is if you do have fibroids and you're going into menopause or you're in menopause, I do think you are a candidate for estrogen therapy.
Yeah, right,
as long as it's, as you're doing the blood work and you're communicating with your practitioner to keep those levels in balance and then working on the symptoms.
Yeah, I definitely think, I mean, her case is very complicated just from what she wrote here, but I do think that she's the exception to the rule. Mm-hmm. Most of the time, menopause 51 and a half, you know, where you are right now, you know, fibroids are going to become a non-issue. If you're using a biased, you know, which is just a transdermal estrogen, you know, 3 to 5 milligrams, it's not going to affect anything like that. But the other symptoms, the poor sleep, the other things that she's complaining about are the concentration, the menopausal brain, quote unquote, those things are going to improve, but not flare up those fibroids. So that's why hers is interesting. She's having all these bleeding issues, but she's using vaginal estrogen. Now, what about, you mentioned that a minute ago. So she's got vaginal dryness. She's using vaginal estrogen. We don't really know what that is, right? She doesn't give any details about what the vaginal estrogen is. We're assuming that it's probably, now she's using Atroche. So that is from a compounding pharmacy, right? Mm-hmm. So we can assume the vaginal estrogen is, we could assume.
I'm hoping it's estriol.
It should be estriol, estradiol. So would you, in a woman like this, would you give her estriol if she's having any vaginal issues? Or would it just have to be kind of a, situation by situation? Some they can tolerate it and some they can't.
Well, I haven't really noticed estriol causing vaginal bleeding. I haven't noticed. It's very gentle. It doesn't necessarily stimulate the uterine lining to create the thickness like estradiol does. Estradiol absolutely creates uterine lining thickness. Estradiol can exacerbate fibroids. So I would say for Alicia, we would do we could do a vaginal estriol for the vaginal dryness. A lot of her symptoms are really speaking to more menopausal symptoms. I'm thinking she's probably waking up 4 to 5 times a night because she could be having hot flashes or even little mini hot flushes that it might not even bringing her to consciousness while she's sleeping. And then you feel so tired the next morning. That's why a lot of women will say, I wake up and I'm so tired when I wake up in the morning. And it could be that they're just having these mild hot flashes that don't bring them into consciousness, but it's enough to keep them out of that deep sleep. So if she's waking up 4 to 5 times a night, I'm thinking it's probably more hot flashes. She might not have mentioned that. She did talk about night sweats, you know, brain fog.
Well, night sweats and waking up 4 to 5 times a night. So, you know, the women that are, what I hear all the time is their covers are coming off on and off all night long. They're hot, they're cold, they're hot, they're cold. Maybe not so much in the winter, but certainly in the summer, they're hot. So they're using a sheet to, you know, keep themselves warm. They get hot, they take the sheet off, they get cold because they're sweating. And then it just goes on back and forth all night long. Mm-hmm. Now, if she got any sleep apnea, that's, you know, more kind of goes into that more metabolic stuff with the pre-diabetes. However, she doesn't say how they determine she's pre-diabetic. One thing that's a trend right now that I really don't agree with is using a hemoglobin A1C as a marker for prediabetes. Okay, her lifestyle sounds very good: walking, lifting weights, eating a high protein, low carb diet. That's not going to make you prediabetic. But if you're looking at the wrong metric, I'm looking at someone's hemoglobin A1C. That's probably a sort of a false prediabetes. However, her overall picture sort of sounds like she could be prediabetic. So there's a little bit of, at least in my mind, there's a little discrepancy there between what she says is happening and what she's experiencing. And I'm just curious how she determined that she's pre-diabetic. Prediabetes and insulin resistant are basically the same thing. Prediabetes is the conventional term for insulin resistance. Pretty much the same thing, relatively. Usually prediabetes in this context, maybe from a slightly elevated blood sugar. Okay. Now, if she's not sleeping well, waking up 4 or 5 times a night, that's going to push up your blood sugar. That's why in menopausal women, our first 30 days is to get their temperature under control and get them sleeping better. So now from a metabolic standpoint, all those other things start to regress. The cortisol goes down, blood sugar goes down, insulin starts to balance out. Just something that I picked up on, and I'm just wondering on how that was determined, if she's pre-diabetic or not.
And I know you were super interested in insulin and insulin resistance. That's like your thing. But I kind of thought the same thing, that her estrogen is finally dropping. She's in menopause. She's not sleeping well. That's going to make her cortisol go up. That's going to make her glucose go up. So, for example, have any of you gone to the lab and you put your arm out and you do a blood draw, and when the results come back, the glucose is like right on the edge, like a 99, maybe 102. And you're like, wait, I don't have high sugar. But the second that needle, for some people, goes into your arm, you have this immediate sort of adrenaline fight or flight reaction. You can't help it. Someone's stabbing you. And that immediately can make that cortisol go up, which can also pull out glucose from your large muscles because you're in this fight or flight reaction. And then you'll have that little elevated glucose on your blood, your blood results. And you're like, am I diabetic? No, it's because of that cortisol reaction. The same thing happens when you don't sleep at night. When you wake up at 2, 3, 3:30 in the morning, 5:30 all night long, you're getting these little cortisol bounces, which then can pull your glucose out into your bloodstream. And then you go for that blood draw and your glucose is a little high. So anytime I see somebody's fasting glucose and I see it slightly high, I ask them, how are you sleeping? Especially women, right, because I know their cortisol is coming up at night. So that's kind of what I thought, is maybe her glucose was a tiny bit over the edge. And they said that, like you said about the hemoglobin A1C, the hemoglobin A1C should not diagnose diabetes, but at the same time, it's a really good learning tool to tell somebody, you know, especially if you're looking at them and they need to make some lifestyle changes, look at your hemoglobin A1C. It's at, you know, 5.96. We, you know, in the next 4 months, we want to bring that down.
Yeah,
so,
right. Yeah.
So I was kind of thinking it was more about the menopausal symptoms, because she says she walks every day, she lifts weights. I mean, I lift weights because you make me lift weights, because we do them together. So yeah. A 57-year-old woman that's just doing weights on her own, I have some real props for her. Yeah. Good for you, Alicia.
That's what I'm saying. From my perspective, because we look at these questions a lot, we see people's intake forms, we're evaluating people's lifestyle, not that we're being judgmental or critical, but there's a disconnect there between lifting weights and walking every day, eating a high-protein, low-carb diet, and then having prediabetes. It makes no sense. However, depending on how erratic her sleep is, if she's waking up 5 or 6 times a night, or would she say 4 to 5 times a night, it's almost like working the night shift. Okay. Literally, it's almost like working graveyard. And there's a lot of good data that, you know, working swing shifts or working, you know, graveyard is not good for your metabolic health whatsoever. When I was in college, I couldn't sleep in my 20s. I was a terrible insomniac. So I decided to work at a hospital and I volunteered for night shift. And for one, nobody else wanted to do it. And I couldn't sleep anyway. So I figured
I'd probably make a little more money.
Well, at that point, not
it's
really.
$2.
Yeah, not
$2.
Really. Yeah, I think it was literally like 75 cents extra an hour or something like that. It really wasn't a lot of money, but yeah, I couldn't sleep. So I'm like, yeah, you know, I didn't mind it. It was pretty quiet. There wasn't a lot going on, which is why a lot of people, at least in hospitals, like to work at night, because it's quiet. You don't have the hustle and bustle of the day shift. But it's boring. Like I was what they call a cardiac monitor technician. And I sat in this room and I would, a room of like 8 computers and watch people's heart rhythms. It was what they call a post coronary care unit. So people that came down from surgery, they just had a bypass, or they admitted from the ER cause they had chest pain or all the other type of cardiovascular problems. They'd be on this particular floor wearing the electrodes on their chest, you know, you got like 5 electrodes, and that gets transmitted to these, they'd have these little boxes, the wires that go to this little box called telemetry, and then that would be transmitted to the computers. It would be a table not much longer than this, and it'd be, all the computer screens there, and we'd just be monitoring them all night long to make sure that their rhythms didn't change or there's any problems. Learned a lot. It was amazing. But it was night shift, so it was pretty brutal. Then I get done in the morning. This is a little side note. I get done in the morning. My friend of mine, he used to like to golf a lot really early. So I get done at, 7:30, and I meet him at the golf course, and then we go golfing for a while. Then I go home and take a nap and then do it all over again. But anyways, my point is about the 4 to 5 times a night, if she's waking up that much, she's not getting any restorative sleep whatsoever. Metabolically, that's going to be a huge challenge. It's going to make her blood sugar, her insulin, her cortisol way out of balance, which could perpetuate all of those symptoms that she's having, make it sort of worse. And really, that the sleep disruption is enough to make her basically pre-diabetic, even though her lifestyle, her exercise and diet are in a pretty good spot. That's why the sleep is actually, as we all know, sleep is very important. So just some extra, making some extra assumptions there, or have more questions about what she wrote.
And like you were saying, so she's got a lot of other symptoms here. You know, the sleep thing, that's a big thing. The brain fog making her job very difficult. So if we're just worried about, don't give her estrogen because it's going to flare up her fibroids, then she's still going to be pre-diabetic, not sleeping, brain fog, not doing her job very good. Probably, she doesn't say on here, but the vaginal dryness probably comes with a little low libido, because that's a huge thing, the dry skin. So I would say, she would be a good candidate to be able to do some estrogen replacement therapy. So that would be, it's just, keeping that balance so that we can take care of some of these symptoms that she has, which will make her feel great, but not flare up the uterus, not flare up those fibroids.
Yeah. So Long story short, someone that has a history of fibroids is a candidate for estrogen replacement therapy. Maybe not in the beginning, maybe not at vaginal, as she, I'm pointing to the page here because I'm just referencing it. So I keep looking at this instead of at the camera. But maybe not in the beginning, maybe not vaginal estrogen as you're trying to figure out how much she can actually tolerate from a systemic standpoint. But then once she's built up a tolerance to it, I wouldn't even say a tolerance, once she's established tolerance, then you could probably add in some specifically estriol, no vaginal estradiol, you know, and that would be able to still address her vaginal issues, but still not flare up those fibroids. So that's why I find this one just to be sort of a little bit of surprise that she's having at the age of 57, having so many problems.
Well, if you look back, you know, like you said, we've been doing this for a long time, working with hormones. She's said she's had a history of heavy periods. So whenever I have a patient, if you hear about, you know, I have a history of heavy periods. I had heavy periods when I was in high school. I had to go on birth control pills to help my periods when I went to college. You know that their uterus is very stimulated by estrogen. Same with genetics, like I'll hear, oh, my mom had a hysterectomy. My grandma had a hysterectomy. In fact, I had a patient I can remember. She was beautiful, thin, lovely gal. Actually, she wasn't my patient. She was a colleague's patient, wanted me to do an exam on her. And she's very thin, and she laid on my table, and I felt her lower stomach, and you could feel the multiple fibroids in, you know, just topically over.
You could feel it.
They were bumpy. And I knew her mother through, cause she, mother would come to the office too. And her mom had terrible fibroids and it had run in the family. And I mean, this woman she had never had children. She was under the age of 30 and you could feel them on there. And we kind of talked about, you know, where is this going to go? What do you want to do about now? Even at her age, you know, are you thinking about possibly, you know, having your own child, you know, birthing your own child, looking at fertility? We had some talks on that. And so is that genetic component. So when you're looking at this, Alicia's saying, you know, we don't know her family history, but I'm sure her mother probably had heavy periods, might have had a hysterectomy when she was younger because of those. She's had heavy periods. You know, in that instant that person is going to be sensitive to estrogen. So when you prescribe an initial dose, you go a little low and then you can work your way up. So also too, one thing is when you also have a woman that comes in and maybe she's never had heavy periods, and granted I've had heavy periods in my past, and she's maybe, has a different athletic build, you can know that her system could probably might need a little extra estrogen to help relieve those symptoms. So you can even tell just by their intake and their family history where you should start them at. So definitely, like you said with Alicia, I wouldn't do any estradiol vaginally. In fact, I would start something more systemically and then work your way up and then possibly work on the vaginal dryness if you even need to at that point.
Yeah, right. So you've brought up a good point there too, which has sort of always been our plan. Our approach is when you're starting someone on estrogen, especially when they're going from, as she says, perimenopause into menopause, we're questioning whether or not she's actually in perimenopause. So it sounds like she might be in menopause and the estrogen therapy is driving the periods. But if she is in a true transition, sort of like we're going to do an episode about you in a little bit, sort of right where you are, right at the end of perimenopause and the beginning of menopause, like where, you know, there's like this little gray area. And we've talked about this before on some other episodes. Are they a candidate for estrogen, or when is a woman a candidate for estrogen or not? And to be honest, there's no real hard and fast rule. It is just sort of try something to see if it works and to see if it doesn't make anything worse, meaning more bleeding, heavier bleeding, more frequent bleeding.
We do the blood work to check the blood levels, make sure they're not super high or super low.
Look at FSH level and you sort of get a sense if they might be a candidate and they might not be a candidate, but sometimes you don't know until you actually try something. Because you can't, you just said blood work, but you can't look at blood work and know whether or not someone is a candidate or not, or if they're going to tolerate something or not. You just can't do that.
Yeah,
it has to be very subjective.
One part of that, information to deduce. Like, for example, here, even with Alicia, she's taking 50 milligrams of progesterone sublingually, because it's a troche. You put it on the inside of your cheek and let it dissolve. So it's a sublingual progesterone twice a day, 50 milligrams. I would say for her, because of her uterus and how sensitive it is with the fibroids and obviously sensitive to her past estrogen, is giving her an oral progesterone. Just in my 20 years of experience and yours too, you know that doing an oral progesterone does thin that lining of that uterus, or you can help offset some, in fact, with just perimenopausal women or women with fibroids that don't need estrogen, but they have fibroids, is giving them oral progesterone can really help calm those fibroids. So there's kind of a combination thing here that if a woman does have fibroids, like I was saying, or had a history of estrogen dominance, a history of heavy periods, it runs in her, fibroids run in her family, I would go start a little lower on the estrogen and work our way up, and then start with a pretty good progesterone capsule, even though she said she took 300 milligrams of oral progesterone. Now, I would say that dose is a little high. She said it didn't help with sleep. But when you're having hot flashes, trust me, all the progesterone in the world is not going to help your hot flashes and night sweats to give you a good night's sleep.
Yeah, right. Yeah. I mean, usually, you and I usually never go above 200. I mean,
Everybody's different, but I know 300 might have been a little overkill. And I don't normally do progesterone in the morning. You don't either. I'll use that for somebody maybe with some anxiety, because she did say it helped doing the anxiety. So maybe some transdermal, sublingual progesterone during the day to help with anxiety and mood, and then doing an oral at night to help kind of offset some of that, you know, some of the fibroid issues.
Right. So, I mean, there's definitely a lot going on, there's that couple of things that just sort of make it, hopefully, if Alicia's listening to this, hopefully it'll give her some insight. But again, this is a unicorn case, right? These, you know, especially at 57, these are not a very... Now, collectively, we look across the country, there's probably thousands of women that are in this situation.
Truly,
so,
yeah.
So even though it is a unicorn case, it doesn't happen that often. Collectively, over the population of 330 plus million people, it probably does happen thousands and thousands of times. So I guess sometimes it's hard to think of those kind of numbers. As far as cases that we see, you know, in our practice, that's partially also why we're doing the podcast, because it gets this type of information out to a wider breadth of people as opposed to us seeing them one-on-one. Maybe I'm just correcting myself. We don't see these very often. These are not very common, but collectively, maybe they're very common.
Honestly, I would say we do see these. I mean, we see a lot of
57 with bleeding fibroids. We don't see that.
Not like being that. Perimenopause at 57. Yeah, so if she's truly perimenopause at 57, those ovaries are rock stars and they are still pumping out some estrogen. Like, wow. I think at 57 when she wrote this question, those ovaries have said, thank you. I've done enough. we're leaving the building. Adios. Right. And that's, you know, all rights to them. You know, the ovaries worked for a long time very well. But we do see this, you know, we do see people that can, I have some patients, they really need a good amount of that estrogen, you know, the bioidentical estrogen, and I have a lot of them that need just a little bit. It really depends on the person.
And me being a dumb man, trying to do female hormones for women, also trying to understand the subtleties, right? You know, that gets missed sometimes. Understanding what works for one woman is not, now granted, I try to do my best at that. I'm trying to be humble on purpose. When you're doing hormones for women, there is never
one size fits all.
Well, there's not one size fits all, but it's never perfect. No, right?
You know, everything's always changing.
There's always going to be some issues, but taking the person's individuality into consideration, that's why I think hormone replacement is challenging, because there is no real, medicine tries to do that a lot, but there's no real cookie cutter approach. You can't do the same thing with every single woman and expect it to work every single time, because it just, you know, it's destined to cause problems at some point if you do it that way.
Absolutely. And like you said, everybody's different. At the same time, when someone has a certain dose, like Alicia, let's say we gave her some dosing and she did really well, probably in about 6 months, we might need to tweak it, because everything's always changing.
Yeah. So I think we've kind of beat Alicia's questions to death. I think we picked it apart as much as we can. We do appreciate all the questions. Visit our website, progressionhealth.com. Now that we're on YouTube, even down below in the comments, I'm not used to ever doing that before, pointing to the comments. When we have more videos, we'll be pointing up to here or wherever to check out other videos. We don't have enough videos yet to do that, so we can't do that yet. But leave a question down in the comments. We do appreciate everyone taking the time, listening to what we have to say. Hopefully it's providing you some value. If it does, please press the subscribe button. We're trying to grow our channel
thumbs up one, right? Is that the other one?
See, we don't even know yet, right? We're just, we're a little bit late to the YouTube party or trying to figure it out as we go. So I know subscribe thumbs up or a like or whatever it is, but Like I said, we're planning on doing, I think what we are planning on doing two videos a week, at least for right now. That may change in the future, but you know, that gets us going. We're trying to, make little improvements and make the videos more educational, more entertaining, you know, make just improve the viewer's experience as we go. So hopefully, we're able to accomplish that.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So until next time, I'm Dr. Mackey.
And I'm Dr. Davidson.
Take care. Bye-bye.